I read it from a reputable green team site. This is from the CelticsBlog.com, right, Murray?
Correct.
Okay. Bobby Manning wrote this the other day, and it was just a survey of the players that came out of the third lottery position. Not the third pick, but the teams that started with the third lottery position and what happened. He said,
This is Cousin Anthony. Welcome to the Bobcast.
I'm going to bomb this.
So that's where I got it from, Dave, just by the way.
Bobby Manning here, the Bobcast. I just listened to Frank Ocean's cover Moon River again that came out in February, and it just got my day going. It's Wednesday, April 11th, and it got me thinking. I think some of the poorest souls alive are the people that are unable to appreciate music. Now, I'm not judging them or anything like that. I don't think it's a choice. It's more just a mental perspective that you're born with. I've read about it in the past, and I actually have met people who say they just can't get into music, you know? Like, it just can be background noise to them. You can enjoy it at a party, but they don't dive into it and get invested with it the way some other people do. Which is too bad. I'm one of the people on the complete polar opposite of the spectrum where this stuff powers me. Like, I don't know what I would do with my life if I wasn't able to infuse music into it every single day. Waking up in the morning, walking around. I get so into music walking around that people will pass me and they'll wave me and I'll just completely blow them off because I'm just getting that much into what I'm listening to. And the great thing about it is you can project what's going on in your life and relate to what's going on in other people's life. It's sort of like a conversation. And the inflections people make, their delivery styles, some of the subtle ways they say things that you could just say directly, just, ooh. Now, there's standards and such, and I think the people who write about music don't get enough credit. It is hard. Talk about music. It is hard stuff. Trying not to be vague. Being as descriptive as possible. Conveying some of the emotions that it pulls out of you. Trying to understand what these musicians mean. Because it's not always inherently clear. I think Frank Ocean's a great example of someone who is a divisive music figure and brings up great debate because people do have different standards of what they want out of music, you know? Some people really follow strict visions of what a good singer is. And I don't think traditionally Frank Ocean's the greatest singer in the world. You know, his range isn't amazing. He's come to rely more on that disruption of his voice technologically. He does that little high, whatever it's called. I just got stuck there myself. Starting with the Nikes track, you really started to hear him take advantage of some of the manipulations, there we go, that he can do with his voice. And I'm not saying the guy stinks at singing, but you probably will hear people out there say he's not the most gifted singer when it comes to range and stuff like that. But what he doesn't have in that sense, he brings an emotion, honesty, flow. I think his singing flows quite a bit. And he does bring rapping capabilities to what he does, as we've heard in the past. But you listen to this Moon River track, and it just hits you deep inside. The chords that he hits, his own personality he puts on the track. Now, I think he's a great cover artist in particular, too, because his voice is just so emotional. Now, Blonde came out in the summer of my senior year, I believe. Yeah. And we had waited for that album forever. You know, Channel Orange was a great hit album. Really drew mainstream success toward this guy. Won a Grammy. Had a Grammy performance. You know, Frank Ocean was breaking on the big stage, and he was one of the forefront members of the group he was in with Tyler, the Creator, and all them before. But, you know, he wasn't a superstar in his own sense, and Channel Orange kind of lifted him up to that platform. Kind of had a niche following before that, but now everyone knows who he is. And he sort of became more famous in an internet sense in that he was just so elusive in a society that expects you to be out there talking all the time, present on social media. Lord knows I am not Frank Ocean when it comes to that sense. I almost feel addicted to keeping myself out there on Twitter and all that. I don't think it's something I could turn away from. But anyway, Blonde drops, and it just blew my world up. Something about the sonic energy of that album really provided a great soundtrack for what I was going through in my life back then. Change, a new home, new people around me, missing pastimes, the way things used to be, and how much power he brought to that. Whew. It brings me back to a moment in time, too, which I think is another thing music is capable of doing. Can bring you to a moment in your life when you were able to relate to what it was you were listening to, what you projected on the album at that time. I listen to Blonde, and I can't help but think of those 7-hour bus rides back and forth between here and Syracuse and Boston. And it would almost bring me to tears. Especially that bridge in Self-Control. Now you're gonna leave. Like, that would rock you to your core. There's certain notes and lines that just rock you inside. And not everything's capable of doing that. You know, I'm not 100% locked in on introspective music, even though it is what I prefer. Overthinking. But I'm able to appreciate a lot of different stuff, you know? And I'll hate on certain songs, and like I heard on another podcast the other day with Drake's new song, Nice For What? Not a big fan of that song. Not the biggest Drake fan in general. I think he can get a bit gimmicky, as people know. And I'm not a big fan of musical gimmicks. Especially when something's clearly not your style and you're just buying into it for a minute. I like people who have a style, a sound that they can stick to, and that can advance over time, but it's got to be you. Now, the Drake thing, you know it's going to be a dime a dozen when he's rolling through it. He's going to stick on something for a minute. Then when he sees an opportunity somewhere else, he's going to take advantage of that then. But if I hear it in a party, you know I'm going to be dancing to it. I was over at my friend's room once, and I cannot stand Lil Uzi. I think he stinks. I think his delivery's so whiny. his music just annoys me in a general sense. I could never sit down and listen to that. But I was having a time over one of my friend's places. One of those songs came on. I don't remember which one it was. And I was getting down to it. So there's a time and a place. There's context for music. Some people separate it from their lives. Some people, it's an inherent part of their lives. There's cultural standards for what people expect out of their music. It's cool stuff. It's life. It really is hard for me to separate this stuff from my life. Just a thought I had this morning. Today on the show, we are talking to Danny McDonald. Now, that has nothing to do with the little monologue I just gave, but he's someone I met a couple months back, sat down with, had some lunch, met him through my neighbor, Layla. He's a cool guy. He's worked for a long time and always had a goal of working at the Boston Globe, and now he's living that out. He's a news producer for them, works nights, covers crime, and anything else they need him to. In fact, he just wrote a story about Harvard and a lawsuit they're involved in. So you can read this guy almost every single day in the Boston Globe if you pick it up. Cool, cool stuff. And he's come a long way from UMass in 2006. Spent time in London. Spent time in Bermuda. Worked for three different outlets before going back to school in London. He worked for Vice for 2 years. Returned to Boston with Metro. And ever since 2015... he has been a news writer for the Boston Globe, so he has plenty of stories to share with us. And I had a wide-ranging conversation with him a couple months ago, got a free lunch out of it, which was great. And one of the most interesting things he said to me then was that he has a particular interest in crime because of the way society treats villains. The way they view villains, the mindset that makes a villain, and how systematic failure can produce a villain. Interesting stuff. Let's talk to him right now.
All right, welcome to the show, Danny McDonald. Danny, first question I got to ask you, how hard did you have to fight to get the byline Danny and get them to stop Ryan Daniel? Because I remember Robert versus Bobby, that was a big battle for me early on when I first got to the paper.
I used to go with Dan. When I first started out, my byline was Dan. And then at some point, actually it was when I started writing for Vice a couple years ago, I just went with Danny because most of my friends and my family calls me Danny. So I just went with that. Yeah, I don't know. There was never any like question or problem with it. No one ever had a problem with it. I was never Daniel. Like the only person that calls me Daniel is my mom when she's pissed. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, you so. Gotta deal with three actually. I'm just back and forth between Robert and Bobby, and no one ever calls me Robert. So when they were putting that down the paper, I was like, come on. Yeah. So you spent time in the Bahamas during your career.
Bermuda.
Bermuda. I get those two mixed up all the time.
Yeah, no, a lot of people do.
How was that?
It was good, man. It was good. Basically, I started as a reporter here in Massachusetts, was a reporter in Massachusetts for like 6 years, moved to London for a year for grad school and did some freelance work there, and then moved to Bermuda. And I was there for about 10 months, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. What brought that move?
I mean, they offered me a job. This is shit. Short answer. After my grad school, I knew I was going to have to leave because my visa in the UK was expiring. So I was applying all over the world, and the Bermuda Sun offered me a gig, and I thought, why not, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Be my rum diary period. be a reporter in, you know, the subtropical paradise.
Did you enjoy that?
It was okay. You know, to be honest, I got bored. I always say it was like eating birthday cake for breakfast, like every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, day one, it's great. It's birthday cake for breakfast. But like by day three, you're like, do you have any eggs? Do you have anything other than birthday cake? You know, yeah. It was a lot of sun and nice beaches and not much else. Everybody in Bermuda is extremely nice, extremely courteous. They all thought I was rude because of my New England directness. They all thought I was really rude. Which took some getting used to. So yeah, I got bored there, I guess is the short answer. And also, the my paper got bought out by our competitor and closed down. So that's what prompted me to move back home.
A few quick stories off the bat. Let's take it back to the beginning. What inspired you to get into journalism in the first place back when you were going to UMass?
Yeah, I guess it's a good question. And it's a fairly typical answer for me, I suppose. I always liked writing, and I always liked people. I think people are fascinating. And it's obviously an industry that combines those two things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and additionally, obviously, you know, a working and robust press is integral to any working democracy. And so that fact held a lot of appeal to me. Yeah.
So, as I said in the intro, Danny is a news writer for the Boston Globe now. Has had some interesting experiences in his career. We sat down for lunch about a month or two ago, bought me a sandwich, which I'm grateful for. And you talked about how you profiled a hitman with the Winter Hill Gang and have had some interesting other high stakes, I would say, subjects. What yeah. was that experience in particular like? Was that the most memorable story you remember working on?
I mean, it's definitely one of them. So the hitman in question is Joe McDonald. He's actually a distant relative of mine. He's mm-hmm. my grandfather's first cousin. So I was working for Vice, freelancing for Vice at the time in London. And Vice is interesting in a lot of ways because it's a very bottom-up news organization. It's not top-down, which basically means that you could pitch almost anything to them and they'll be like, okay, well, go for it, give it a try, and if it works, it works. We'll run it, and if it doesn't work, we won't run it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot of, you know, other media organizations are top down, where you know it's much more you're given an assignment, do this. So there was a lot of freedom advice, and I'd always been interested in Joe McDonald. I'd always heard stories, family lore, or whatever, you know, of him. He's a relatively well known. Winter Hill Gangster in Boston. He's long dead now,
mm-hmm.
but like he features in a lot of the Whitey literature, the Whitey books. So yeah, I reached out to some folks who knew some folks who knew Joe, and ended up getting to sit down with Jimmy Minorano, who knew Joe very well in the North End, and some other folks who were around Somerville around the same time that Joe was, Paul Moran and Bobby Martini. So, yeah, it was just interesting to hear their stories about Joe and about the Winter Hill Gang. Yeah, it was definitely an interesting and kind of intense process because you're asking people to talk about things that are not legal
yeah.
in a lot of ways. So that can be its own kind of delicate process where you want to get information from them, but that you don't want them to completely shut you down.
And that's the good stuff, too. Like, that's what you're looking for when you're in journalism. Is there any tips to getting people to be more comfortable with coming out with that? I know, of course, you can, you know, give people anonymity at times, but that's not what you strive for, of course.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't think there's any magic bullet or magic formula. It's like anything else, the more you do it, the better you become at it.
Mm-hmm.
At least that should be the case. I always try to make interviews a conversation, so it's less an interrogation
mm-hmm.
and more of, you know, more of a conversation. Sometimes it needs to be an interrogation because sometimes you have a limited amount of time and you need certain questions answered, or sometimes it's just going to be a tough discussion. You know, and that's unavoidable
mm-hmm.
at times. So it kind of depends on the subject matter and the subject, I'd say.
I remember you telling me that you do cover crime. One of your biggest interests in being in that area is that you like the villain perspective. You like understanding how these people think, their perspectives, why they're vilified by society, that sort of thing. When did that emerge as an interest of yours?
Right now, what I'm doing is a lot of breaking news crime,
yeah.
which is necessary working for a daily newspaper. I mean, that stuff does need to be covered. I think crime in a macro sense is fascinating because in a lot of ways with serious violent crime, in many cases, it's kind of a failure of a whole bunch of social fail-safes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
when somebody shoots somebody, usually, you know, that's the end product of a bunch of failures, right? Sometimes the school system has failed the person who's doing the shooting. Their family has failed them. The church, if that's a thing in the community, has obviously not reached that person. The economy has failed them sometimes. So I think it's interesting to look at crime in a macro sense, to look at what leads a person to this point in their life where they feel like they need to commit crime. I think that's a really interesting story. I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah, that's I don't know when it emerged for me as an interest. It's always kind of been there, I guess. I think crime is just inherently interesting.
Yeah. Do you think you're able to convey that theory of yours effectively to people? Because a lot of people just have images of what criminals are. You know, they're just bad people and throw them away in jail. I mean, that's like a big issue in America in particular when you think about mass incarceration, is the inherently negative association people have with criminals, even if, like you said, the system has failed them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like I said, in my current role, so I'm the nighttime general assignment reporter. I'm the GA guy. Mm-hmm. And that means a lot of covering a lot of crime, covering a lot of shootings, stabbings, house fires, fatal car crashes, stuff like that. And so a lot of my job now is to just go to the scene and get as much as we can, like right away, mm-hmm. as fast as possible. And oftentimes it's not possible to paint this, you know, long and textured and holistic picture of, the person who has perpetrated the crime. That's just not possible on our deadline. You know, sometimes
you,
it is.
You
sometimes
have done, you have done work with that in the past, though, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Winter Hill stuff. I've covered a little bit of Boston organized crime. When I was at Vice, I did some international drug trade stuff. Mm-hmm. I did a little bit of terrorism stuff, international terrorism. I've interviewed, IRA, former IRA hunger striker. I've interviewed a South African convicted terrorist, stuff like that, where you do have the opportunity to kind of get a more fuller picture of what was going on that led these individuals to do certain things. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes, when somebody's shot in, wherever, Boston or Cambridge or Chelsea or wherever, you're going to the scene, you're simply not going to get, a person's life story that night. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes. Occasionally you do, or occasionally you do get family or friends or neighbors to talk and lend some insight into either the victim of a crime or the person who allegedly perpetrated the crime. But oftentimes you're kind of scrambling, just to get the facts, who, what, where, why, how badly is the person injured? Is the suspect still at large? Stuff like that. So it's a very fluid situation.
What's it been like translating to sort of that narrow scope of stories, where in the past you had more space, you had more time, and it's definitely two different jobs, when you compare what you did at Vice to what you do now at the Globe. Do you have a preference or?
I mean, the short answer is I'm just there to use a tired sports cliche. I just want to help the ball club in any way I can. Whatever they need, Bobby. You
Come
know
on,
what I mean?
Give me the podcast content.
So like as a GA, it's kind of like a lot of it's crime because I work at night. But if they need business stuff, I'll do business stuff. If they need education stuff, I'll do education stuff. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, if they need sports stuff, I'll do that. Arts and culture, if they need that, like whatever they need as a GA. I mean, that's kind of the cool thing about being a GA is that like you get to wear a lot of hats and you get to do a lot of different things. The flip side of that is, your knowledge is a mile wide, but an inch deep sort of thing. You're not able to develop a beat as much where you have like this deep and textured understanding of a specific issue.
Are you being assigned a lot of these stories? I saw you wrote about Harvard and the lawsuit they're involved in the other day. So you definitely do get outside sort of that as it comes to your news. Is a lot of the stuff come to you from the top, or have you had a chance to pitch stories there yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the Globe it's a mix, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, being the nighttime GA guy, you do need to be ready to react to what they need. You know what I mean? There's not a lot of chin stroking going on. You know what I mean? There's not a lot of time for consideration. It's kind of like you just, okay, somebody got shot, you know, in Dorchester, go there, you know, give us a live feed from the scene, tell us what you can right now, sort of thing. It is a lot of, you know, you are getting, a lot is being thrown at you. You do get to pitch stuff, but I would say in the current role, because of the nature of news, they need someone there to react. And mostly right now it's reactionary. My stories are reactionary. So something happens, I go there and write about it, sort of thing.
You had several stops at several outlets between when you graduated from UMass and when you made your exodus, I guess, to London. What inspired you to go back to school after working in the field for so long after getting out of school originally? That doesn't seem like something I'd be able to do personally.
So I was in Massachusetts for 6 years, graduated UMass in 06. My first job out of the gate was at the Gardiner News, which is a small city in north central Massachusetts. It was a tiny 6-day-a-week paper. I covered City Hall and government for them. It was one of the last family-owned papers in the Commonwealth. It just got bought, actually, by Gatehouse, like recently, I think last month. You know, the pay was crap. My salary put me well underneath the federal poverty line. Well underneath the federal poverty line. I was there for a year. I moved to Metro West Daily News in Framingham. Covered the town of Hudson. Covered the town of Framingham. Was there for about 2.5 years. Then moved to the Standard Times in New Bedford. Covered crime in City Hall in New Bedford. New Bedford's a great news town. A lot going on down there. They have a fishing industry. A lot of crime. Immigration's a pertinent issue in New Bedford. So a lot of stuff going on down there. I was there for about 1.5 years. Then I went to Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly. That's a legal industry publication in downtown Boston. I was only there for 8 months because I decided I didn't want to interview attorneys every day for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And then I moved to London. And the reason I moved to London for grad school was because I wasn't getting the types of gigs I wanted to get. Specifically, I wasn't getting into the Boston Globe. I wasn't getting into that building, the Globe building. And I knew that in order for me to stand out, I would need to do something different, something that I hadn't been doing. So I moved to London for a year, got a grad degree, freelanced mostly for Vice, got some good bylines for them, bartended at night. And then I got the job at Bermuda. So I was in London for a year, got the job in Bermuda, was in Bermuda for 10 months. Then our paper got bought out and dissolved. So then I moved back home, worked for the tabloid Metro Boston for 6 months, and then the Globe hired me after that. So I've been at the Globe for a little under 3 years.
How long was the Globe a goal of yours, and how many times did you try to get in there before it actually happened?
I think any kid, at least for me, I mean, I don't want to speak for every prospective journalist in Massachusetts, but I don't think I'm unique in that any kid who's, I think, grown up in Massachusetts and wanted to be a journalist, I think the Globe is in their sights for a goal. You know, I think for me, it's always kind of been the mountaintop, which sounds corny, but, you know, I can't remember ever not wanting to work for the Boston Globe, put it that way, you know. I probably applied, I would say, more than 15 times before I finally heard yes. So, yeah, I mean, but that's part of the industry. I mean, part of the industry is rejection. You know what I mean? You're going to be told no a lot. That's not unusual, I don't think. So, yeah.
What changed for you personally as a journalist after your London experience? Do you think that experience in particular made you much better because you talked about how you weren't getting into the buildings you wanted to prior to that? Or was it just the degree that you picked up that you think changed your fortunes in that sense?
Well, I think a couple things. I think, I think that it definitely changed my worldview, you know, because I had basically never lived outside New England. I mean, I'm a kid from Massachusetts. I went to UMass. And so, like, I was exposed to just a lot of different a lot of different stuff, a lot of different news, a lot of different stories. At Vice, I was able to get a lot of good bylines. And Vice at the time, this was in 2012, 2013, was viewed as kind of this up-and-coming kind of global young media power. So I was able to get some kind of good, I would say good bylines for them. We talked about some of the Winter Hill stuff that they published. You know, I was able to cover international drug trade, as I said, for them, and just do a bunch of just like really solid bylines. And that was kind of a game changer for me, I think, the Vice experience, because Vice was looked at as like this global brand. You know, you're not talking about parochial Massachusetts community newspapers, which are very important. I'm not trying to diminish their importance, but like Vice is kind of a different ball game. I mean, at the time they had offices in more than two dozen countries. I don't know what it is now.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that, and plus a big part of the gig, big part of the news gig is being able to be parachuted into these situations and kind of getting acclimated and finding your way around. And, I mean, living in London, you know, you have to do that or else you'll fail, right? I mean, coming up in Massachusetts, you have this institutional knowledge of Massachusetts politics, of Massachusetts culture, of Massachusetts sports, history, all that stuff. The stuff I was doing at Vice, you know, a lot of it wasn't Massachusetts-based. Mm-hmm. So I had to, it made me get better at becoming acclimated, if that makes any sense. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah.
What's the biggest screw up of your career?
Ha! That's a great question, Bobby. Well, there's been a few. I mean, if you're working in this industry, you're gonna mess up. That's just. I mean, humans are fallible. We're fallible creatures, right? I would say.
Come on, you got one.
No, I do have one. It's just I don't know if I want to share it publicly. is the issue.
Don't think about it, just do it.
Yeah, I mean, there's been like some pretty embarrassing like just like spelling goofs and grammatical goofs that have made it into print.
I
under
know
my...
you got a big one though. I can feel it coming off your tongue. Yeah.
I wouldn't say this is a screw up, but this was probably the I'll say this is like the dumbest assignment I've ever had to do. Vice, they brought it back. For a while they didn't do this, but when I was there they had this question of the day. And so every day was this question of the day. And they would assign a different journalist every day to go around and ask people this question. And one time I had to walk around East London and ask people what the coolest thing they could do with their genitals was. So, yeah, I had to do that, which was not great. And then, the other thing was they wanted photos of the people who answered. So it was basically like a man on the street. We call it man on the street. In Europe, they call it Vox Pops. So it's basically you just go out on the street and you ask people, like, this one question, right? And so after this question, which is, like, obviously, like, this embarrassing and incredibly juvenile and dumb question, I had to get them to okay to have their photo, their headshot, like attached to their quote. And I had to find five people in East London to do that. Eventually, I mean, it took me like 2.5 hours, but eventually we got it done. So I would say that's the dumbest assignment I've ever gotten. One, I'm trying to think of in terms of mistakes. Oh, one time, there was a story. It was a First Amendment lawsuit in Massachusetts. I'm not going to say the paper, or really detail any of the details about the story. But there was a First Amendment lawsuit in Massachusetts that I covered, and the lawsuit involved this website, which was a political website, and it was a very long and complicated acronym, and I messed up, and I had switched two of the letters of the acronym in the middle of this long website name. So we had the actual name of the website wrong in print. And instead of going to a political website you were led to a very different website, shall we say. If you typed in this this particular web address.
That's what I'm looking for.
So the next day, like, I show up to the office and my voicemail is just filled with, and I have to say it's mostly old people, basically very upset that they went to this website and was not the website that we that we were writing about, shall we say. So yeah, that's probably like the most embarrassing I guess.
That wasn't hard. That wasn't hard. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We got 5 minutes here. Time's been flying. You've been great, Danny. I guess the last question I'll ask you, I'll ask two at the same time so you can pack them in the 5 minutes, even though I don't like to do that. What's the best piece of advice you've gotten in your career that you just remember exactly who said it, who gave it to you, that you've kept with you all these years? And do you remember the moment you found out you got the Globe job?
In terms of advice, I honestly don't remember any specific advice about the job that, like, you know, was like this eureka moment or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, thing about the job, it's a grind, man. It's a grind. And I honestly, I wouldn't advise people to get into print media or even web-based media. It's not a stable industry. Layoffs are a fact of life. There's been layoffs in many of the papers I've worked at. I lost my job when the Bermuda Sun went under. The pay is crap, especially at first. You know, many internships are unpaid or lowly paid. You know, cliche in the industry is that the pay is crap, but on the plus side, everyone hates you, you know? So, I mean, you need to really not only want to do it, but you need to need to do it. For me, I mean, for me, I don't know if I could do anything else and honestly be happy. It has to be a pathological thing if you want to make it in this industry. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's a thing. So yeah, it's just no specific piece of advice, but just, you just got to, if you want to do it, you got to do it. You got to produce the work. You just got to grind. There's no shortcut, to success, you know? You have to be okay with rejection, you know. I think it's weird because I think most writers are racked with uncertainty and self-doubt. But you know, you question, am I good enough? I think a lot of people in my industry, that's there, that lurks in the background for a lot of print journalists with respect to their work. And it's funny because in order to make it, you do need a kind of a self-belief that borders on the irrational, because you will get rejected. So there's this weird sort of push and pull, I think, with a lot of print journalists, of this significant insecurity, but also just like unshakable self-belief that, you know, a therapist could have a field day with, probably. In terms of the second question, do I remember? Yeah, I remember the moment I got the Globe job. Yeah, of course I do. You know, it's funny because I was leaving Metro Boston anyways. I had accepted a position at a paper in Cambodia, and I was moving to Cambodia in like 3 weeks. I was getting the Japanese encephalitis shots. I was getting the malaria shots. Like, I was going to move to Cambodia and cover, because I really wanted to cover the developing world for a long time. And then the Globe called. And I hadn't heard from them. I had interviewed at the Globe, but I hadn't heard from them in like 2 months. And they called and offered me the gig. And so I had to call up Cambodia and tell them I'm not coming. So yeah, I mean, it was great. The gig was a web producer gig, graveyard shift from 10 p.m. to 8 a.m. So like, not a glamorous job at all, but like, I was, you know, ecstatic. I was over the moon. Yeah, so yeah.
That's Danny McDonald. You can read him almost every day in the Boston Globe. That was good stuff. Thanks so much for being on, man. And maybe we'll talk to you again one day.
All right, Bobby. Thanks a lot, man. Have a good one.